KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Unity can't itself be a strategy, otherwise the church ends up working and looking at itself.
As the papal conclave approaches, who will decide who the next pope will be?
We'll shed light on the process this Monday, May 5th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. More than 1,000 grants have been cut at the National Science Foundation.
The agency funds science research in universities across the country.
That would be a crisis. It's just a catastrophe for U.S. science.
Also, starting this Wednesday, if you want to fly anywhere, you'll need a picture ID that's compliant with the Real ID law.
And did you know, not only is today Cinco de Mayo, it's also Square Root Day.
If you're confused, well, we'll tell you what that means.
It's a good day to get things squared away, to try to fit a square peg into a round hole, go square dancing.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump says he wants to reopen California's Alcatraz as a federal prison. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports the move is raising questions about whether the island penitentiary can be brought back into operation more than 60 years after it was shut down.
President Trump says he wants to reopen Alcatraz to house what he calls the worst criminals, reviving the image of one of the nation's most notorious prisons. But can it happen? Experts say the costs would be staggering. There's currently no functioning infrastructure, and mostly everything would have to be rebuilt. The island was closed in March of 1963 because it became too costly to maintain. According to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Alcatraz was nearly three times more expensive to operate than any other federal penitentiary. Additionally, the island is now a protected historical site managed by the National Park Service. And reopening the prison would likely require a congressional act. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Veterans groups say what President Trump is calling a big, beautiful bill includes a dangerous loophole. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports it would make the GI Bill benefits more accessible to for-profit schools.
The Republican policy bill working its way through Congress currently includes a repeal of the 90-10 rule that says for-profit schools can get no more than 90% of their revenue from federal funding. It's a market test to make sure at least 10% of students would pay their own money to go. For years, though, there was a loophole. GI Bill benefits were counted in that 10%. That meant for-profit schools aggressively targeted veterans for enrollment, including so-called diploma mills that drained veterans' benefits without providing a useful degree. Legislation finally closed that loophole in 2023, but veterans advocacy groups are flagging a line in the current Republican draft bill that would eliminate the 90-10 rule altogether. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp says he will not run for U.S. Senate next year. Rural Valley of member station WABE reports it's a setback for national Republicans who wanted Kemp to challenge Georgia's Democratic incumbent.
In a social media post, Kemp says he told President Donald Trump and U.S. Senate leadership of his decision and that he would work to find a Republican nominee who could win in Georgia next year. State and national Republicans believe Kemp would be the best candidate to challenge John Ossoff, the only incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator running next year in a state Trump won in 2024. Kemp defeated popular Democratic figure Stacey Abrams twice for governor, along with defeating a Trump-backed Republican challenger in 2022. Possible options for Kemp include running for Georgia's other U.S. Senate seat or for president in 2028. For NPR News, I'm Raul Bally in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 98 points. This is NPR. The event known as the Conclave, where a successor to Pope Francis will be chosen, begins this week, and as per tradition, will be cloaked in secrecy. All the Vatican personnel involved in the process take an oath, a violation of which would result in automatic excommunication. At a ceremony today mandated by Vatican law, participants took that oath. Nearly 135 cardinal electors gathered at the Sistine Chapel Wednesday to be in the process of voting in secret. This year's Pulitzer Prizes honoring journalism, music, and letters have been announced. The New York Times won 4 awards and The New Yorker 3. NPR's Andrew Limbong has more.
One of those New York Times wins went to Doug Mills for his work photographing the attempted assassination on President Trump in July. He told NPR in an interview the day after that he didn't realize what he had caught on camera until after he sent his photos to his editor.
She said, there's actually a picture with a bullet going behind him. And I said, oh my God.
The staff of the Washington Post won the Breaking News Reporting Award for their coverage of that day, and Reuters won for its investigative reporting into the fentanyl industry. Author Percival Everett won for his novel, James, and the Biography Award went to David Greenberg for his book about the late Congressman John Lewis. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
President Trump today announced the 2027 NFL Draft will be held on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Trump flanked by D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, and Josh Harris, owner of the Washington Commanders football team. Most recent draft in late April was hosted in Green Bay. It drew 600,000 fans over 3 days. Pittsburgh will host the event next year. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Rome on the edge of Vatican City. In just a few days, 133 cardinals will enter the papal conclave and elect the next leader of the Roman Catholic Church. For those cardinals, the period between Pope Francis's death and that election is a time for reflection and debate about the future of the Church. They've been gathering every day here at the Vatican to talk about what challenges the Church faces and what kind of person they might choose to face those challenges. Joining me now are longtime NPR Rome correspondent Silvia Pajoli, as well as NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hey, good to be here.
Silvia, I want to start with these meetings. They're called general congregations. What issues are the cardinals discussing?
Well, according to official Vatican statements, the discussion has focused on big and kind of vague issues like the relationship of the Church with the contemporary world, missionary outreach, and relations with other religions, but also more specific problems like the worldwide clerical sex abuse scandals that have been handled very poorly nearly everywhere, and the sorry state of Vatican finances, where there's been a big drop in donations. It's an institution that doesn't impose taxes and most of whose revenue comes from museums and real estate.
Jason, you recently had an interview with one of these cardinals who will be making these big decisions. What did he tell you?
Well, I spoke with Cardinal Michael Cherney, a Jesuit from Canada. He's a newer cardinal, just since 2019, and he's concerned about the way some in the Church talk about this idea of unity, the idea that the Church must speak with one voice about issues like same-sex relationships or the role of women in leadership. He says that way of thinking really quashes discussion.
What is an example of how the tension in that choice that's being framed is playing out in a concrete way?
Well, Scott, we've seen migration as a tension point among Church leaders. Pope Francis, in fact, even chastised one prominent European cardinal for refusing to help refugees. Migration is about economic opportunities, it's about war, it's about climate change, making certain places just too harsh to live. And Cherney, important is what the Church and the world do about migration.
Certainly the way in which we are responding to migrants is a good example of our incapacity to manage a very, very traditional human reality. It's a scandal, and we should pull up our socks, but precisely pulling up our socks is governance.
And Cherney sees governance as something both the Church and the state need to do a better job at, governing themselves to respond to the needs of refugees and immigrants, to care for some of the neediest people on the planet.
Sylvia, you hear that interview and they're talking about real world political issues and theological issues of the Church. Sometimes there's overlap, sometimes there's not. How do those different factors play out in a conclave?
Well, there are new cardinals from places that never had cardinals before, Tonga, Haiti, South Sudan, for example. They're outsiders to the Roman bureaucracy here and the arcane ways of the Vatican. It's hard to predict how they'll vote. What will electors be looking for? Should the next pope continue Francis's reforms and at a fast pace or slow them down? Age will be a factor for those wanting a short papacy, and charisma will also be very important. And there are many different views on geopolitics. For example, the agreement with China, of which Cardinal Pietro Parolin, who is a front runner, is the architect, and which is very much opposed by conservatives, especially in the U.S. church.
Jason, we're looking at this centuries-old basilica in front of us, but we're also seeing big TV screens spread throughout it. How does technology change this centuries-old process?
Well, the church may be old, but it also always lives in the present, and technology is very much on the minds of the cardinals. In fact, Cardinal Czerny has a really arresting phrase he uses to talk about it.
The digital continent is actually where more and more people are spending more and more of their time. So the church has to go out into the new continent, just like our missionaries have done since Jesus rose from the dead.
Similar to the ways the church sent missionaries to the Americas or Asia or Africa, and it suggests that one of the things cardinals might be considering in the next pope is how open someone might be to new ways of being the body of Christ in the virtual world.
I love that phrase, the digital continent. Are there examples of cardinals who really are at home there?
Well, there's a lot of talk about Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle from the Philippines. He's a little younger than many other cardinals at age 67. He's dynamic and he has real presence online. Only somewhat, though, through his own making. Scott, here is a TikTok video a fan made that uses AI to depict Tagle in papal scenarios, like speaking from that balcony here overlooking St. Peter's Square.
He's young, he's emotional, and he's not from Europe. Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, Filipino, global, and deeply beloved.
Tagle seems to be very much one of those missionaries to the digital continent. But that video in particular gives some people pause because it seems like a campaign ad, and a fellow cardinal in the Philippines asked people to stop making them.
It absolutely sounds like a campaign ad. Sylvia, that's an extreme example of something that is a factor here. How do cardinals walk this line and campaign without campaigning?
Well, the word campaign is taboo here, but of course it's going on. The cardinals are not just meeting in the lecture hall. They're having conversations all over Rome, in hotels, restaurants, and cafes, wherever. They're getting to know each other. They're exchanging notes, making alliances, promoting their favorites. But that's all behind the scenes, and we get to see very little of that.
Sylvia, one thing I've been thinking about all week is why non-Catholics should care who the next pope is.
When you first asked me that a few days ago, I answered facetiously because many have seen the movie Conclave. Mm-hmm. More seriously, I think the last three popes have been much more than just leaders of the Catholic Church. All of them, in one way or another, became political figures as well. Pope John Paul II is considered by many to have been the catalyst to the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. On the negative part of the scale, Benedict XVI caused a global firestorm in the Muslim world, riots and even death, with his remarks that suggested the early spread of Islam had been accomplished through violence. And finally, there's Pope Francis. He became a superhero for the secular intelligentsia by championing the fate of the environment and the plight of immigrants, the poor, and victims of war. I have a sense that this time of so much fragmentation in a multipolar world, the next pope is also likely to play an important role on the global stage.
That is longtime NPR Rome correspondent Sylvia Pajoli, as well as religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Thanks to both of you.
You are welcome.
You're welcome.
The Rockettes are celebrating their 100th anniversary. The dance troupe has been going strong since 1925, and recently, Rockette hopefuls from across the country lined up for an open call audition in New York City. NPR's Jennifer Venasco went to Radio City Music Hall to meet them.
They came from far.
Naples, Florida.
Honolulu, Hawaii.
I came from Paris, actually. That's where I'm living right now.
In near.
I live on 50th, so I just walked down.
All with one hope.
Being a Rockette has been my dream, like, ever since I can remember.
That's Reese Daly. She's 18. She's first in line today.
Yes, I am. I'm super excited.
And it's her first time auditioning. She's originally from Bozeman, Montana. Behind her is Alyssa Gallagher. She's 28 and from Pittsburgh. This is her 10th try.
The whole journey has been long, but I've been patient, and I'm continuing to go for my dream.
They go through security, check in. They're given numbers to attach to their fronts, like a marathon, and start stretching on the floor of the lobby, which has chandeliers and a gold leaf ceiling. John D. Rockefeller wanted Radio City Music Hall to be so grand, even Great Depression audiences would come to a show. And it is. It opened in 1932, but the Rockettes started earlier, in 1925, in St. Louis, Missouri. Here they are in the 1930 movie, The King of Jazz. Listen close, they almost sound like one dancer. Adrian Gibbons Ehlers is a theater and dance professor at Wittenberg University and a former Rockette.
They began as a company of 16 dancers, and they called them the Rockettes.
That became 36 dancers.
To sort of be able to stretch across this giant stage of Radio City.
The dancing they do is particularly difficult. And Ehlers says, at the time, precision dancing was also cool and newfangled.
You know, these ideas of industrialization were really prevalent. And so how do we do things mechanically organized in unison? That was a novelty that was really interesting and very awe-inspiring.
So much about entertainment and society has changed since 1925. We're not usually wowed by factory machines anymore. And it's hard to get people off their couches and into theaters. Ehlers says, yeah, that's the trick. The Rockettes need to keep routines people love for the nostalgia factor, like Parade of the Wooden Soldiers, which they've performed every year since it was introduced in 1933. But they have to balance that old stuff with something more contemporary.
It should feel like, hey, it's a party.
Like the combination the Rockettes hopefuls are trying out today.
5, 6, 7, and then everything comes out. Ha!
The Rockettes' big shows are the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and the Christmas Spectacular at Radio City Music Hall. That's the dream. And after they learn the routine, dancers enter the large rehearsal hall to audition in front of the director.
5, 6, 7, 8.
In groups of five, they turn, they kick, and after they've all gone, numbers are called.
68, 31, 1.
Which means these are the women 11, who get to come back tomorrow.
7, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6.
The Rockettes wouldn't give us an exact number of how many people made it through 3 days of auditions and callbacks. They said it's typically between 4% and 7%. But even those who make it aren't necessarily cast. Some of them will be invited to a development program. Some of them will be in the show. And some of them will be waiting online again next year. Jennifer Venasco, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The tiny Maryland town of Emmitsburg voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump last November. Many residents wanted him to slash federal spending, and so it came as a jolt when the Trump administration canceled classes at the National Fire Academy in town. The academy is the facility for training firefighters in the U.S., and it helps drive the local economy. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Emmitsburg.
I'm standing next to the lone traffic lights here downtown. The main street, it's lined with a lot of old red brick buildings. There are about 3,000 people here in Emmitsburg. And the first one that I went to see is the mayor. His name is Frank Davis, and he's also a captain at the local firehouse. And Davis, he spent many years in the federal government, and he says he saw a lot of waste and voted for Trump in hopes that he would root it out.
Actually, I know I'm probably going to get shot for this, but he is doing what he said he was going to do. And I know that's not popular with a lot of people, but being in the government for all those years and seeing the waste, and he said he wanted to clean that up, that was very, very attractive to me.
But Davis was shaken when the administration targeted the fire academy. He used to work there and says it's well-run and efficient. It's also a big part of Emmitsburg's identity.
They need to get back up and get the students back here. There are plenty of rocks to look under, but the National Fire Academy is not one of them.
Davis says the government is reviewing the academy's operation, and he's hopeful classes will reopen soon, especially given the growth in western wildfires, and even nearby.
30 miles to the west of us, we had a 1,200-acre mountain fire, wildland fire, last week. That we've never had anything like that around here before, that of that magnitude.
If these cuts are permanent, how will you feel about the administration going forward?
Yeah, it will change my outlook to say that they're not being fair. They're not taking a good hard look. They're just going in to cut and not caring what they cut.
Dennis O'Neill served as superintendent of the academy for 2 decades. He says the academy trained 8,000 to 10,000 firefighters on campus each year. O'Neill calls it the National War College for firefighters.
The National Fire Academy takes men and women out of their comfort zones and they expose them to real serious tragedies and forces them to work through what kind of decisions are they going to make, what kind of assistance do they need, where do they get the assistance.
If the courses aren't restored, O'Neill says the country will pay.
We're on a very long, slow path to self-destruction. Every day that this training is unavailable to the locals is one day closer to a disaster they can't handle or won't know how to handle.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency oversees the academy, which pays for firefighters to come to Emmitsburg. In a statement, FEMA suggested it had canceled training because of the travel cost. Quote, "The bottom line is we are no longer paying for non-employee travel. We're only authorizing travel for mission-critical programs. This isn't one. Some of these classes are still available online."
My name's John Beck. I'm the fire chief of Waynesboro Volunteer Fire Department.
Waynesboro's just north of Emmitsburg in Pennsylvania. Beck works there as a fire chief for free. He'd applied for a weekend leadership and development course at the academy this summer. Now, he's disappointed.
So it was pretty exciting to find these classes that, you know, you just can't find anywhere else.
Like Mayor Davis, Beck voted for Trump.
I think smaller government, to me, was maybe less wasteful spending, but I don't see wasteful spending as training first responders. You know, we're only, 100 plus days in, and I wish things were going differently.
But it doesn't sound like you regret your vote.
You know, I'm not 100% there yet, but I it may not take much more.
Back in Emmitsburg, the dinner crowd is arriving at Ott House. The family-run pub is the watering hole for firefighters in town to train at the academy. Thousands of their fire department patches blanket the walls. One of the managers, Laurie Harley, reads a few.
Taiwan City Government Fire Bureau, Seminole County. This is Bath Iron Works from Maine.
Firefighters make up more than 30% of the pub's business. Co-owner Susan Glass is worried about the long-term impact.
We expect a big drop. I've already told a lot of our employees that, you know, it's a possibility they won't have a job for the summer, but we're hoping things open back up.
Glass also voted for Trump, but thinks he's moving too fast.
I agree a lot of things that they're doing, but sometimes I disagree on how they're doing them.
Give me an example.
Maybe not all at once. Spread it out a little bit. I don't know. It just seems like it's just one hammer after another.
Some members of Maryland's congressional delegation have pressed the Trump administration for answers and say they've heard nothing back. Here's U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat.
There's no good explanation for this because this is a cost-effective program that protects, you know, the public across America.
Van Hollen calls the cancellation of classes, quote, extremely short-sighted and dangerous. Frank Langford, NPR News, Emmitsburg, Maryland.
Alcatraz once held some of America's most infamous criminals, names like Al Capone, Machine Gun Kelly, and Whitey Bulger. The island prison shut down more than 60 years ago, and now President Trump says he wants to reopen it to house what he calls the nation's most violent and ruthless offenders. As NPR's Scott Newman reports, history suggests that could be a costly and complicated move.
With a helicopter whirring on the tarmac, President Trump on Sunday told reporters about his latest idea, to revive Alcatraz.
But it's a symbol of law and order, and it's got quite a history, frankly. So I think we're going to do that, and we're looking at it right now.
The president says he's ordered the Bureau of Prisons, Department of Justice, FBI, and Homeland Security to reopen and enlarge the notorious facility. Jolene Babiak lived on Alcatraz Island as a child and teenager. Her father was an associate warden there. She's written several books on the history of the maximum security prison. Here's what she thinks about Trump's announcement.
My reaction was two words, water and sewage.
The sewage from the inmates and their guards was dumped straight into the bay. She also says that resupplying the island proved extremely costly, three times the operating costs of other federal prisons at the time.
They used to say you could put a man in a Waldorf Astoria. Today it would be Trump Tower. You could put a man there and that would be about what it would cost.
At the peak, there were barely 300 inmates at Alcatraz, less than 1% of the federal prison population at the time. But thanks to movies like 1979's Escape from Alcatraz, the prison has taken on a mythical status.
Alcatraz has some symbolic register, particularly for someone of Mr. Trump's generation.
That's Dan Berger, a historian and professor at the University of Washington, Bothell. He says today it would cost tens of millions of dollars just to bring Alcatraz in line with current standards for federal prisons, let alone expanding it. But he says an island prison presents other obstacles.
Visiting and family contact becomes much more difficult as well. So doing something on the mainland is better for all parties involved.
And if the prison reopened and the museum there closed, San Francisco would lose one of its biggest tourist attractions. The National Park Service says 1.2 million people visit the island each year. Scott Newman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Pope Francis appointed most of the cardinals who now elect his successor. Many, like Francis himself, came from outside Europe. So how might they vote, and what does it mean for the Catholic Church? The cardinals in the conclave on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ilse Chang. If you're going to be boarding a plane for a domestic flight starting this Wednesday, make sure to bring the right kind of ID.
It has to be compliant with what's called the Real ID Act.
It will make it more difficult for people to come up with an acceptable ID.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump says he wants to meet with the film industry to talk about imposing a 100% tariff on productions made outside the U.S. As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco tells us, many around the world are confused by how the tariffs would work.
Trump talked to reporters in the Oval Office about his 100% movie tariff, saying America's film industry has been decimated by other countries offering production incentives.
Hollywood doesn't do very much of that business. They have the nice sign and everything's good, but they don't do very much.
For decades, films and TV shows have gone to other countries like Canada, Australia, and the UK, which offer productions generous tax incentives, rebates, and grants. Trump says he wants to make America's film industry happy by bringing productions back, but he gave no details, leaving studios, filmmakers, and others around the world confused and worried about what it all means. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Israel plans to seize more of the Gaza Strip under a plan to stay in the disputed Palestinian territory, vastly expanding its operations. Israeli forces still haven't allowed humanitarian aid to cross into Gaza for the past 2 months. That's prompted the UN to call out Israel, saying vulnerable civilians are at risk of starvation. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more on Israel's plan to seize a larger portion of Gaza.
The Israeli cabinet approved new plans last night. The plans are to intensify the war in Gaza, and Israeli officials have offered some basic details. They plan to seize more land in Gaza and to have soldiers stay there indefinitely, and also to push the population of Gaza into the southernmost area of Gaza along the Egypt border, where they would get their food and basic supplies.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin. Stocks finished lower to start the week on Wall Street, breaking a 9-day winning streak. This is NPR. Rare, diverse spring flowers are in bloom at Great Smoky Mountains National Park, home to more than 1,500 flowering plants. From member station WUOT, Jackie Sieber reports.
The spring ephemerals in lower elevations of the park usually go dormant in the summer months. Some flowers, like the yellow trillium, can only be found in southern Appalachia. Visitors are encouraged to download the app iNaturalist to document the spring flowers and other wildlife. The nonprofit Discover Life in America uses data from that app to keep track of plants and animals in the park. Todd Witcher is the executive director.
We have a project through iNaturalist called Smokies Most Wanted, and so we try to encourage people to look for some very specific things we're wanting to know more about or where it is in the park.
Visitors are advised to avoid picking the flowers. For NPR News, I'm Jackie Sieber in Gatlinburg.
Less than a year after completing a restructuring plan, the struggling pharmacy chain Rite Aid has filed for bankruptcy protection again. The company CEO says Rite Aid was unable to secure additional capital from lenders to keep the business operating. The company ran 2,300 stores in 17 states before its first Chapter 11 bankruptcy back in 2023. Rite Aid is laying off workers at its Pennsylvania headquarters and looking to sell all of its assets. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Today marks 4 months since toll congestion pricing took effect in part of Manhattan. The $9 daily vehicle fee was supposed to reduce traffic and raise much-needed money for the public transit system. So how has it been working? We're going to get details from Stephen Nesson, transportation reporter with member station WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
How has it been going?
Traffic in Manhattan is much improved. By some calculations, there are some 82,000 fewer vehicles each day coming into the congestion zone in lower and midtown Manhattan. That's a 13% reduction compared to the last 2 years of traffic. So clearly it's working. But from a driver's perspective and those who have to pay to enter an area that was once free, well, just take a listen to Tony Smith, a delivery driver from New Jersey.
Sucks.
Well, why does it suck?
Because it's too much money. We can't afford to pay that and pay toll coming out of New Jersey.
You don't think the reduction in traffic makes up for it?
It's not a reduction in traffic. Only in the beginning, but not now.
Is it hurting your bottom line?
Is it?
That's right. A $9 fee on passenger vehicles. That's in effect from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. on weekdays. And on the weekend, it starts at 9 a.m. and goes to 9 p.m. But there is a 75% discount for all vehicles during the overnight hours. But trucks like Tony's truck, which create more congestion, they have to pay as much as $21.
All right. So clearly some drivers are not too thrilled. What about people more broadly? How's this going over in New York City?
There was a Siena College poll from March that found 42% of New York City residents want the congestion pricing toll to stay. About a third think it should be killed. That's a change from December when it had much less support. But there are other impacts that people really like. For example, bus speeds are now 4% faster in the zone. And an even wilder statistic are traffic speeds through the Holland Tunnel. That's the tunnel that connects Lower Manhattan to New Jersey. It was notoriously clogged with traffic backed up in all directions. Traffic speeds through there, Ari, are improved 48% after the tolls went into effect.
Wow.
That's where I met Courtney Behrens today. She works nearby at a landscape design firm near the entrance to the Holland Tunnel.
We used to have huge amounts of honking every single night, and immediately after congestion pricing, that has absolutely gone away, except for sometimes on holiday weekends. It's been pretty incredible as somebody who works here in this neighborhood to not be super stressed out by stressed out drivers.
Another fascinating impact with fewer cars in Manhattan, the number of crashes and pedestrians injured by vehicles is also at its lowest in years, since the pandemic, really, when there were very few vehicles on the road.
So why has the Trump administration tried to kill the congestion pricing plan?
Trump, who's from here, made his career in New York City and on the campaign trail vowed to kill the tolls once elected. He says it's unfair for drivers. His transportation secretary, Sean Duffy, ordered the tolls to be turned off, and the state's transit authority, which runs the program, refused and immediately sued the Trump administration for a couple of reasons, including that these are state roads they control and that the federal government had previously signed off on this congestion pricing plan.
What has the transportation secretary said about that?
Well, Secretary Duffy says one reason he's against the tolls is because it forces drivers onto the subways, which he says are unsafe. But the reality about subway safety is somewhat mixed. Overall, major crimes are way down on the subway. There's been a surge in police. Assaults are still stubbornly high. And last year, there were 10 murders, which is twice as many as the year before. But let's remember, all the money from congestion pricing goes to improving the subways, buying new signals, upgrading the electric system, and replacing those train cars, which do date back to when Richard Nixon was the president.
That's WNYC transportation reporter Stephen Nesson. Thank you.
Thank you.
The National Science Foundation funds research in everything from geology to astrophysics to psychology. It's the government agency that supports basic science in colleges and universities across the nation. But recently, the NSF canceled more than 1,000 previously approved grants, and the White House wants to slash the agency's funding, eliminating more than half of its $9 billion budget. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports on how scientists are reacting.
Mariana Zhang works at New York University. She's a cognitive scientist who studies how children develop racial stereotypes and how to disrupt that process.
So that was basically my project, to look at those two questions.
She was in the middle of a coveted two-year fellowship from the National Science Foundation that pays for both her research and her salary. But as she drove to a science conference recently, she got an email.
And, you know, I pulled over to read the email, and I was just numb.
It said her research was no longer part of the NSF's priorities. The funding was canceled.
So it was just shocking. And, you know, I cried out there on the side of the road.
The NSF has terminated hundreds of grants in recent weeks. Amy Hagen is a PhD student in geochemistry at Virginia Tech University. She needed some money to date some rocks from the Cambrian period.
I applied, was awarded the grant on Thursday, and then had it canceled on Friday.
Other grants that got the axe would have helped students attend the Rust Belt RNA meeting, or paid for scientists who study climate change, or research hummingbirds. Noam Ross is executive director of a nonprofit called R Open Sci. He started a database so that people could self-report NSF awards that had been ended. He said a lot of them are programs that train and support student scientists.
At all sorts of institutions all over the country, lots of mid-size and minority serving and rural, like colleges and institutions.
He says a lot of the programs are on a list released by Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas earlier this year. The senator's office deemed the programs questionable because they promoted diversity, equity, and inclusion, or what was called, quote, neo-Marxist class warfare propaganda. But Ross says plenty of the cut projects aren't on that list. He says the impact is wide and sometimes weird.
I'm just looking at this. There's a conference on geometry and topology that was canceled. Why was it canceled, right?
He says maybe the grant for this NSF-funded meeting mentioned scholarships so that students from underrepresented groups could attend. While all these cancellations were happening, the director of the National Science Foundation abruptly quit. The journal Nature reported that all funding for new grants was halted. The NSF had no comment. And then the White House put out a budget for 2026 that would eliminate over half the agency's funding.
That would be a crisis, just a catastrophe for U.S. science.
Sudip Parikh is the chief executive officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, one of the world's largest scientific societies. He says he's optimistic that Congress won't go along with that drastic funding cut, but the budget process will take months. Meanwhile, the uncertainty will be weighing on scientists who worry about how they're going to pay for their labs and their students.
And so that's created this paralysis that I think is hurting us already.
He says some researchers have started talking about exit plans. In New York, Mariana Zhang is thinking about trying to appeal the cancellation.
It's quite scary what's happening, you know, and I think it's also shaken my faith, you know, in the short term, all this is going on, but also in the long term.
She says she's now seriously thinking about non-U.S. options for her scientific future. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Ahead of Mother's Day this Sunday, our story today comes from Vivian Curran.
When I was a young mother with my three-year-old son, who was wild from the get-go, he had no sense of self-preservation or preservation for others or their belongings. So I didn't take him out in public very often. But one day, I decided to take him to a public park. And there we were, sitting in the sandbox, with another nice little girl and her mom sitting nearby. And of course, my son picked up a big pile of sand and threw it straight at the other little girl. I was horrified. I leaned over to my son and said, "Benjamin, what do you do now?" And he said, "I help clean her up," which he did. And then I said, "Why do we not throw sand?" And he said, "Because it could hurt other people and other people don't like it." And then I said, "And what are you going to say to your friend?" And he said to her, "I'm sorry, I won't throw sand at you again." And in the few seconds that followed, I assumed the girl's mom was judging me, because that's what most moms did to me when I was out in public with my wild son. This mom turned to me and said, "That was masterful." That's it. She said, "That was masterful." And all I could think to say back was, "I've had a lot of practice." What I wish I had said was, "You have no idea how much I needed to hear that today." This woman made me feel like a good mom. And I will never forget her words, her tone, and the way it made me feel. I have no idea who she was, but if she hears this, I'd like to say thank you.
Vivian Curran lives in Cumberland, Maine. Her son Benjamin is now a teenager. He loves reading, talking politics, and spending time with his younger sister. He plans to go to college and major in engineering. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. As of May 7th, this Wednesday, if you want to board a plane, you'll have to show a picture ID that's compliant with the Real ID Act. That is a federal law passed 20 years ago. And it means you'll have to show a federal ID, such as a passport or one of the Real IDs issued by states. NPR's Martin Costi has the story of why the law took so long to be enforced and how it'll affect citizens and non-citizens alike.
A lot of people assume that Real ID was a product of 9/11, but the truth is Congress's worries about unreliable state IDs date back even earlier than that, to the fertilizer bomb used in Oklahoma City in 1995.
Because the Oklahoma City bombers bought their fertilizer using a counterfeit ID made by a wife of one of them on an ironing board.
Brian Zimmer helped to draft the Real ID Act as researcher for the House Judiciary Committee. Though he says credit for the name goes to the committee chairman, former Republican Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, who asked his staffers fresh out of college how young people talked about IDs.
What do the kids call when they have to bring their actual state driver's license to a concert? Oh, the cops are going to check. So he said, well, you're told to bring your real ID.
The law had two big goals, to make state IDs harder to counterfeit and to get states to be more thorough in verifying the information on those ID cards. Easier said than done.
It's probably more complicated than I ever thought it would be.
Faith Bradley is a professor of information systems technology at George Washington University. She wrote her doctoral dissertation on the Real ID Act back when the law was only 10 years old.
When I wrote my dissertation, I was thinking it's just a requirement. People fulfill the requirement and get their ID. But then it comes with ideology, view of the world, technology, your identity, how much information you share.
She says about half the states resisted Real ID at first, citing cost, privacy, and the burden for some people in providing extra documentation. The feds kept delaying the deadline and negotiating with the states, and eventually we ended up with different kinds of Real ID.
Now serving 670 at counter 14.
Washington State, for instance, offers enhanced driver's licenses, originally meant for border crossings, but now accepted by the TSA. But those are for citizens only. Most people lined up at this licensing office near Seattle are still going for the plane licenses, even though those won't work soon in airports. Lucia Orozco just got hers. We don't travel much, so it won't be a problem, because we just work here and my kids are in school and we're fine, Orozco says. In Washington state, non-citizens will have to use something like a foreign passport or a green card to fly. Other states are offering real IDs to non-citizens if they have legal status. And then there's the question of people in the country illegally. Tanya Broder is senior counsel at the National Immigration Law Center.
It will make it more difficult for people to come up with an acceptable ID, but before and after Real ID implementation, there were always risks to traveling while undocumented.
The Real ID Act allows states to issue second-tier licenses if they want to, even to people without legal status. 19 states do so. Those licenses are valid on the roads, but they won't work in airports. That compromise was built into the law in 2005, but now it's under threat from the Trump administration. It signaled that it may punish states that issue licenses to people in the country illegally. Critics of illegal immigration welcome this move. Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies.
Driver's licenses unlock access to a lot of privileges and benefits that shouldn't be available to people here illegally, including employment and welfare benefits. So sending the signal that they can stay here easily and hide in plain sight.
While the Real ID deadline in airports is finally upon us, the nationwide system is still under review. Brian Zimmer did consulting work on ID laws after he left his job in Congress, and he says TSA is now auditing compliance. And it's starting with the states it thinks have done the best job, giving a little more time to those that may have yet to fully reach the federal standard. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Today is Cinco de Mayo. This year, the 5th of May is also something else, Square Root Day. NPR's Ari Daniel explains and shows his work.
This all started back in 1981, says Ron Gordon.
I was writing a check in late August. I said, wait a minute, next couple weeks it's going to be 9981.
September 9th, 1981. That was going to be a special day for Gordon because the number of the month, 9, multiplied by the day, 9, would be the year, 81. That is, the square root of 81 is 9. So Gordon called the day...
Well, that's square root day.
And he drummed up a fair amount of press for it.
I probably rolled my eyes and thought, oh, here we go.
This is Linda Gordon, Ron's wife. She draws cartoons for the website that Ron's put together, squareroutday.net, where he's got a handful of other mathematically themed days he's come up with.
When it was 11-11-11 with all the ones, and we called it ones upon a day.
Then on February 2nd, 2022.
We're going to call it Trump a day because it goes two-two-two-two. So for me, each of these is just a little math, a little smile, and a little fun.
Though Gordon's daughter, years ago in elementary school, wasn't so sure.
She goes, Dad, if these are really holidays, how come we have to go to school?
Square Root Day comes along only 9 times each century. So the Gordons say one must celebrate the day when it's here.
We will have square steak with root vegetables cut up in cubes. Well, he will drink root beer. I will sip it because it's not my favorite, but don't tell anybody.
It's a good day to get things squared away, to try to fit a square peg into a round hole, go square dancing, root for the underdog, or watch the pigs root around.
Today is extra special because the year also happens to be a perfect square. That is, 45 times 45 is 2025. Terrence Blackman chairs the math department at Medgar Evers College. He says Square Root Day is a reminder that math is all around us.
It allows us to, you know, in a way, wonder about the world in which we live and the patterns that inform our lives.
Blackman says square roots aren't just mathematical oddities. For example, they matter quite a lot in cybersecurity.
Square root is a very powerful thing. It helps with encryption, decryption, absolutely. It makes a number of the things that we do in our electronic world work and work efficiently.
Back in 1981, when Ron Gordon launched this thing, he was a high school teacher in Redwood City, California. He's since retired. Today marks the 6th time he's actively championed Square Root Day.
And I'm still feeling young, but I'm afraid this is my last mathematical hurrah because I'll be 90 on 6636, so Ari and the listeners can take that one over.
So here's to Ron Gordon, the square root of 9 cheers to him. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available.
Corino, where you been so long? Corino, baby, where you been so long? Ain't had no loving mama since you've been gone. Corino, where you stayed last night? Corino, where you stayed last night? Come in this morning, baby, sun was shining bright.